Welcome back to the BBC. Today's episode, Why These Hoes Are Trifling. Our guests. Welcome back to the Wolverine Patrol, everybody. Welcome to another exciting week of fascism talk with Jack.
Yay!
Got Jack, we got Ron here. John is still out and about. It's the holiday season. People are busy. He'll be on again in a couple weeks. We know you miss him. We know you love him. We miss him and love him, too.
He's still recreating that scene with the bear from The Revenant.
Oh, shit. I forgot about that movie. Isn't that the one they finally gave Leo the Oscar for like, some reason?
It was. All he had to do was, like, crawl inside of an actual bear carcass to get an Oscar.
Man, you know, much like, I don't even know where I was going with that. Much like capitalism is a bear carcass.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
To get the gold, you gotta cut it open and make it your bitch.
Oh, but fucking Tom Hanks crawls into, what's his car? What was that thing in Star Wars?
Tom Hanks was in Star Wars?
Not Tom Hanks. Why did I confuse Tom Hanks and Harrison Ford?
No, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, the big...
The Tauntaun.
Yeah.
He grew into a Tauntaun.
Harrison Ford has an Oscar, doesn't he?
Does he?
I don't know.
I just love how he hates Star Wars.
Imagine, I'm just going to say things and just assume they're true from now on. That's the kind of podcast we are,
the
folks.
Movies that Harrison Ford did. You think those got Oscars?
Nah, you're probably right. Damn, you're right. I'd give Harrison Ford an Oscar.
I do love, there was something like before the new ones came out, he was on Conan, and Conan was like, here is $600 of my money. I'll give this to you if you can tell us anything about a new Star Wars. And Harrison Ford took it and said, I hear they're thinking of making a new one.
Jesus Christ. Beautiful. Amazing. And then he died. He gets murked in the first movie, so he just doesn't
have to do it. Because he wanted out, because he hates it. He doesn't want to be in it.
Yeah, he's like, I don't want to do Han Solo again. Not for three or four movies.
No, he really, and apparently that was part of his demand. He was like, you can put me in, but you have to kill me off within the first one. Because I don't want to keep doing this.
We are so honored to once again be named South Ohio's number one Star Wars and Communism podcast. Woo! Yay. But enough about fascism in space. We need to get back to fascism here on Earth.
Indeed.
Earth is in space.
Fuck, you're right. God damn it. But enough about fascism elsewhere in space. We need to get to fascism this where in space. This where, right here.
So
we're moving on. We got a handful, you know. So what's the name of this article again, Jack, if you want to catch everyone up on kind of what we were talking about in the last four or five points last time?
Yeah, so the article is 25 Theses on Fascism by Shane Burley, author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It.
Welcome to Fascism Today.
Fascism Today.
It is what it is. And how to
Genocide
end it.
Before the weather.
Genocide before the weather, Christ. Yeah, that's probably what that would be like if that was a thing.
So we're just going through these points one by one, and we just kind of toss them up for discussion and try to connect them to some ways that the far right in America is displaying some of these characteristics, and talk about how we can recognize fascism and how we can combat it. So we got through points 1 through 5 the last time. We ended off on a point about violence. So this next one kind of switches gears a little bit and goes into the direction of culture, which is also kind of, I think, a primary battlefield upon which fascists are fighting in America today. There's definitely talk of a culture war,
right?
You know, in the U.S. Point number 6 says, today, fascism is largely built on metapolitics rather than explicit politics. Fascist projects attempt to influence culture, perspectives, and morality as precursors to politics. This puts much of their work into the realm of art and music, philosophy and lectures, counter-institutions, and counter-power. This is the development of a fascist value and aesthetic set, not simply a fascist political program.
Now, I appreciate this point a lot because it reminds me of a great article I read once from one of the... a formerly really great source, which was Cracked, and I remember, that great political source of the early 2010s, Cracked.com.
No, I only read Mag Magazine for the porno.
I would legit say Cracked had like a small hand in my radicalization, though.
My cousin wrote for Cracked.
Oh, really?
Yeah, cool. Just a handful of articles, but yeah.
But the one I remember is the one where the guy talks about, you know, kind of coming around and not being a white supremacist anymore. And he says, and I'll never forget that, he's like, you know, everybody's seen Indiana Jones. You don't walk up to people and go, hey, you want to become a Nazi?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this sounds like. You have to find ways to influence people's kind of cultural values through the culture first.
That reminds me of a quote of somebody we should probably talk about at some point when we do, like, maybe a movie episode or something. But Boots Riley, the great Boots Riley. Absolutely. From...
Oh, yeah, The Coup.
Who went on to... He's been a film guy for years, but just now got to make one, which was Sorry to Bother You.
Great movie.
But he had a quote where he said, all art is inherently political. You're either going against or holding up the status quo. Politics can mean many different things.
Right. Right, your art is either subversive or it's not, and by virtue of being subversive in some way or not subversive in some way, it, you know, you are making some point, whether you even if you don't make a point, that's still a point, right? Right. I mean, I think that's the important thing to remember, is even if you're intentionally, like, going out of your way to be non-political, that's still a political statement in a time when things are very political. And I mean, I guess things have always been political, but especially as charged as they are now, you know, people are against the status quo. So even supporting the status quo is a political statement.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that, like, the part where it says philosophy and lectures to me is really interesting because it reminds me of, like, Jordan Peterson and, like, Steven Pinker, and even to a lesser extent, like, Milo Yiannopoulos, that guy, remember him?
Congrats on pronouncing his name correctly on the first try.
But, like, a lot of those guys get called out for being fascists or proto-fascists, and, yeah. Like, they go back and they say, well, read my work. I'm not out there, you know, advocating for genocide. I'm not talking about explicit, like, yeah. Racial
I'm not saying we need an ethno-state.
Right, like, I'm not outright saying that we need an ethno-state, therefore I'm not a fascist. And it's right. Like, no, like, your whole value set that you're building with this lecture about how, you know, everybody is a free and individual actor and failures are all on the individual and you need to clean your room first. You can't tell anybody what right. to do before you're perfect. And, like, that kind of, like, hyper-individualism lends right. itself really well to the development of, like, I've got mine. Fuck everybody else who doesn't right. have theirs values.
And it also, it separates things so much from the material condition that it certainly doesn't explain why people of color in this country are so systematically poor versus white people. So again, you're kind of leaning back on racial stereotypes in a lot of ways. And you're leaning back on ethnic stereotypes in a lot of ways because it... you're not providing an explanation for why these divisions exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're providing an explanation that says, well, I'm not saying that they're inferior. What I'm saying is everybody has the same choices in the same 24 hours, and why are their outcomes so different?
Right.
You know?
And we'll never...
And kind
we'll,
of just
yeah.
hinting down that path of right. like... But all the while, you mask it under this, like, mirage of talking about personal responsibility and, like... individuality in the abstract, you know, kind of right. like philosophical individualism,
right?
You know, and it gets so and I mean, especially you talk about, like, Jordan Peterson, like, his work is so obtuse. Like, you read passages from his books and you're just like, what the fuck are you even talking about?
I was watching an interview that he did recently, and yeah. All I watched was this clip. I don't know the context of this clip, but the interviewer just asked him, so are you still eating your all beef diet? And he just responded, in an instant, without even thinking about it, unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, well, that whole thing with his daughter is really interesting, too, where, like, she, isn't she, like, the proponent of that?
Yeah.
His daughter?
She, like, borderline kidnapped him, took him to wherever, like, Slovenia or something.
Siberia.
Siberia, yeah, and she's, like, forcing him Serbia. To eat, like, nothing but beef.
He also had COVID and got really sick, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, if you're eating only beef, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be, man, how do you even shit when you eat only beef?
Oh, trust me, you're going to shit.
Will you without the vegetables, though? I don't know. I guess it depends on your body. I feel like if I ate nothing but, like, meat, I would just, oh no. I'd be like a giant cork ready to just pop.
Yeah.
No, I remember, this was probably 6 or 7 years ago, I tried, like, the paleo diet for a second, right?
Yeah.
And I remember saying to my, to Jenna at the time, you know, I get that why they call it the paleo diet, and it's because our Paleolithic ancestors could just shit whenever they had to.
Yeah.
Because, oh my God, I'm shitting 20 times a day.
Oh, yeah. No, that's my question. It's like, literally, not even like jokingly, how is he still alive?
Yeah.
The brain is fueled by carbs. Like, your body needs good sources of carbs.
And fiber.
Like, yeah. I don't understand.
I have a theory. He is lying.
Yeah. Or sneaking oatmeal.
He's sneaking oatmeal. Dad, what do you have in your mouth? Spit it out. No, I won't spit it out. No.
So this really have just like a Miss Piggy and Kermit situation going on right now.
Father, why aren't you eating your beef?
Oh, shit.
Oh my God, I spent too much of my youth trying to learn how to do the Muppets, and I've got like 4 of them kind of close.
That was pretty good. I'll give you that one.
Kermit! Jordan! Oh man, anyway. Can we just do a whole episode about Jordan?
No, a whole episode just as the Muppets.
As we each
pick our respective Muppet.
Well, I've always wanted, I've told you that I want to do a reading of Uncut Gems as either like the Disney characters or as the Muppets, right?
Oh, shit.
I heard you resurfaced your pool, Howard! That's not true, Arno!
That's not true, Waka Waka.
Fozzie's Howard Ratner?
Yeah, Fozzie for no reason.
All right.
Anyway, I'm sorry. We cannot go off on this tangent. This will be here for 2 hours.
Oh, no. That would be tragic.
Oh, man.
No, but I agree. I think getting back on point here, like, it definitely, you can't start with the hard-end political side of fascism. It really does have to use its blunt edge first, which, you're right, is reactionary media that draws in certain crowds of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, like, if you talk about, like, the development of a fascist aesthetic,
yeah,
and you look at, like, how in American media, like, there's so many police dramas. And there's so many like military like dramas and movies that come out like and
always very special good boys in those movies.
Yes. And the tropes that like, that you can run through all those movies are part of that fascist aesthetic, right? Like there's always the leading man who's very, you know, white, blonde haired, blue eyed, and like
he's David Boreanaz. Yeah.
Yeah.
The subtle things like that, putting those lead characters into those positions of power in those films and those TV shows, and kind of just like setting up an image of the world as an ethno state, even if the real world doesn't reflect that.
Right.
You know,
it's one of the weirdest aesthetics, dudes who like are super into the military aesthetic and the military gear and the camo and all these things, but never served.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that on the far right.
Yeah,
and I think that's another thing where you're talking about adopting that cultural aesthetic that even if you didn't serve or whatever, like you're still, you know, you're a bootlicker, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really the whole point.
You identify with the military uniform of the time.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why, you know, back in the day, plenty of people who wore the brown shirts in Mussolini's Italy did not serve in the military, but they wore similar uniforms to the military to show their, you know, because part of fascism is nationalism and that like that upholding of the nation's military strength. Right. And having masculinity and youth and virility and like all those classic fascist values, right,
mm-hmm. Right,
are all perfectly encapsulated in the young man marching off to war.
Right.
And so like the adoption of the camo in the United States is literally, I think, just because that's what our military wears and they want to be aesthetically similar to that because it shows like, oh, well, I support the military, therefore I dress the way that they do. I think that it's cool to look like that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. We just did like 15 minutes on that point. So,
oh, dude, I mean, you want to talk about fascism in American media? There's a lot of material.
I was about
there.
To say that could be the whole damn episode.
Yeah, there's
honestly
a lot of material there, yeah.
Man. And I mean, I think it's interesting too because you do run into that in comedy a lot, and I think that Ron could probably speak to that. You run into like a real reactionary bent in comedy.
Oh, yeah.
That's definitely influential to the culture in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, and the whole these are not a great example, obviously, because of what we know now. But somebody like Louis C.K. had that kind of legendary bit of his where he was like, well, I'm not using the F slur in a homophobic way. I'm using it to, you know, as a refer, you know, that kind of bit that he had.
Right.
And even he said, he was like, I stopped doing that bit earlier than I would stop doing most bits because I saw that people were thinking it was giving them a pass to just throw it around willy-nilly.
Right.
And Chris Rock, where he was like, he had the famous
N-word versus black people.
Yeah. He was like, I stopped doing that because I saw like white people who thought that it gave them, like, again, the chance to just kind of throw that word
around. And to just be racist. Yeah. Right.
So it's like, we can talk about how, like, you know, it's just comedy or it's just a movie, da da da. But these are people in their fields talking about, like, oh shit, I saw the influence and to an extent power that my stupid joke had.
Right.
And I stopped. I stopped doing it.
Right. It kind of like, have you ever heard somebody say that like the N-word just means ignorant person?
Yeah.
Literally, it doesn't mean that. Like, where did you get that from?
No.
But I feel like that was like a bit or a joke or like something somebody said once in some something. And now it's literally just like a cultural thing people again use to justify like using a slur. Yeah. Like, what the fuck?
Nah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and like you look at the way that in social media, a lot of these characters that use those racial slurs, like Peaky Blinders comes to mind, right?
Right.
They have like this glorification of those guys and the way that they like were so, you know, kind of white nationalist at a time in Britain where like they were against anybody who wasn't a white British person, right?
Right.
And they like idolize that person and they want to be that person. And it's like kind of like what we were talking about a couple episodes back, like, no, you're not supposed to like them.
Yeah,
you know, that they're not, that's not supposed to be a good trait that they're so racist against Italians, like,
right?
Well, now hold on, now hold on.
No, I mean, you do get a lot of that too, where it's like even media that like it could be considered you know, subversive and like not political in like in a generally positive way can be taken if the cultural kind of lexicon is like fucked up enough or like skewed enough for a person, can be taken that way, where it's like, just because you know, Tony Soprano is an excellent example, just because you do paint him as like a real person and a fully three-dimensional character that you're occasionally sympathetic for or whatever, does not mean you're supposed to think he's a cool guy or want to be like him. But there are definitely people that watched Sopranos and that was their takeaway.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
yeah.
That, you know, I think that that's really telling as well.
Or the same thing of just like everybody who took away the wrong thing from something like Fight Club.
Right.
Like every bro in the 90s who took away like the absolute opposite message from movies like Fight Club.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and I think if you have that fascist value set and that fascist aesthetic,
right,
and that's the filter through which the young men in your society are viewing these pieces of art, even if they were intended to be subversive in the opposite direction, they can take those wrong messages from them because they see those things that are being satirized, you know, like the like they're satirizing that toxic masculinity in Fight Club.
Right.
But they don't see it as satire. They see it as glorification.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where satire gets
tricky. Well, and here's the thing, and this is my kind of two cents I can put into this. As somebody who's been doing stand-up comedy for over 10 years now and going around everything, the slightest, tiniest bit of satire and irony flies right the fuck over 70% of people's heads. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just my honest finding from doing comedy in a vast amount of different settings and cities and things like that.
Right.
Just straight whoosh over people's heads. It's like, no, I'm being ironic. It's right. It's satirical. I don't know why or what that is, but I mean, yeah.
Well, I think we don't, our society doesn't want people to think in subversive terms, right? So, yeah. I mean, we don't do a very good job teaching people about irony and you know, things like that because we don't want them to be good at using it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think maybe I'm being extreme here. I don't know, but. We don't see it as like a value, so.
Well, when you're taught about like irony in school, you're taught about it like with like Greek plays, you know, like classical literature that's kind of hard to digest, and they don't really, you know, I don't remember a time in my education when somebody like watched modern media and was like, ah, see, now that's irony.
They're
using satire there. Like, no. Like, you learn about those things with, like, classical literature, and, like, you don't ever... A lot of people just don't make the connection. You know, they're like, oh, well, that's something that we learned about in this old book in high school, so I forgot about it.
I have, like, this bit... It usually goes over really well, but I have had my nice amount of rooms that I've done it in where they don't get it. It's like a fake anti-weed PSA I'll do at the beginning of my act. And I'm like, I took one hit of marijuana once, and now look at me. That's right. I'm in a wheelchair. And I say that as I'm standing up. And I've literally had whole crowds stand at me like, what? It's like, no, I'm standing right in front of you.
Yeah.
That's the joke, is that I'm not. This is, okay, fine.
Yeah, I've seen that joke go both ways when you perform.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I don't know. People are funky, man, when it comes to that kind of, and you're right. It's, we don't teach these rhetorical, man, we should really wait to have that conversation when Liz is on again, because discussions of like rhetoric and like what we don't teach people in that regard is, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yikes. So what's the next point?
It actually kind of flows pretty well from that. So
hell yeah.
Point number 7 is the values set by fascists enable them to use methodologies traditionally associated with the left, including mass politics, post-colonialism, anti-imperialism, and anti-capitalism. Fascists employ the power of the marginalized classes and redirect their anger against systemic inequality and alienation against other marginalized people, thus reframing the source of the crisis.
Literally the reason the Nazis are called the National Socialist Party.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right? I mean, literally, that's what that point is.
Or the co-opting of any kind of, like, imagery. I mean, even something to the extent of, like, Pepe.
Right.
Or the OK sign with the hand. It's these dog whistles that these groups can use that a lot of people will look at and be like, of course an OK sign isn't a symbol. Dude, come on. You're overreacting.
Right.
But they rely on that train, that thought process, to signal those dog whistles to each other.
Right. And then they absolutely do use mass kind of thinking and mass language to get to people. I remember one of the scarier groups, and they ended up falling apart hilariously because one of them was like fucking his stepmom or something. Some insane. Do you remember the Traditionalist Workers Party down in Kentucky?
No.
And Matthew Heimbach and all those guys? They were this far right group down in rural Kentucky that, you know, had chapters all over kind of Appalachia and like the South, and their whole thing was like, yeah, Main Street over Wall Street, and like, we're anti communist, but we're like pro socialist, but like actually the Jews need to leave the country also, and like a lot of that kind of shit,
mm-hmm.
And it was they were very. I remember thinking that guy was very, very effective at using kind of leftist mass language to be like, we're alienated, we're tired, we're pissed off. But then, of course, then the bait and switch is it's the Jews or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. We've talked about the knife in the back and other things like that on previous episodes. But it's huge. I mean, it's very, very important for them to be able to co-opt left-wing language.
Well, look at Donald Trump. Donald Trump's whole thing that he rides off is like, the American people are tired, working people are tired, we're going to drain the swamp and like work for the working people, not realizing that like there is no more better example of the kind of powerful rich people that like we're actually sick of than Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Right, but he's good at using the language that nobody else will use.
Right.
Because the rest of neoliberalism has to clench up and like not even fucking acknowledge, you know, in any real way, like the systematic issue there. So anybody who's willing to get out there and go, we're going to bring jobs back and people are tired and people are pissed off and alienated, is going to strike a chord somewhere. It's the same reason I think, you know, Bernie Sanders, despite having zero support from the establishment, did amazingly well in two primaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that like it's interesting, too. I've seen a lot of stuff about like pro-Trumpers saying that it was a good thing that Trump didn't start any new wars and that he reduced the number of total U.S. troops abroad, right? And so it's interesting that they take that, like, anti-imperialist stance, right?
Yeah, a lot of them are, like, weird isolationists. It's definitely a thing, which is, again, like, a left-leaning thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it can be.
Right, like, if it's done for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Anti-globalization because of capitalist exploitation versus because you want to isolate yourself from every culture that's not white and Protestant is two very different things.
Yeah. But I mean, and that goes into point number 8, which is because of their strategic revolutionary orientation, fascists have historically been able to draw on disaffected areas of the left. There is no revolutionary tradition that is free from far-right entry, wherein the flaws of radical left analysis and practice allow for fascists to present an alternative and recruit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We think a lot about, you know, it's funny because my experience is like, you know, Western white leftists has been the other way around, where people were like kind of, they were at that crossroads when they were like weird libertarians, and they either became fascists or they became like leftists. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them kind of made that kind of from like right libertarian to left swing. But it's not that surprising to me to think that that could go the other way.
Yeah. Well, and I think that there's a lot of like in anarchist circles, and especially right. since 2015-16 with the rise of the alt-right, people who are either snitch-jacketing each other and calling each other secret fascists, or yeah, you
which
know,
is
actually,
yikes.
Which is yikes. But then actually, you know, I'm sure that there are some people who initially were on that like that ultra-left side, and it's easy to kind of get back around to the fat, like to be convinced that you had your analysis really close, but you missed this part, you know. And there's just like that little piece of disinformation.
Yeah. Somebody can throw a little nationalism, some spicy nationalism in there somewhere. Yeah, I mean, there were definitely a few guys that I, from what I understand, that were like involved with Occupy that became fascists and stuff locally, and you know, it's very unfortunate, but you know, it is what they do. They're very sinister. And
well, then how
they're
much,
very good at it.
And then also, how much of that is a almost in a way, if you can't beat them, join them?
Yeah,
kind of attitude. Just to, like, defeat. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that it's that, but it's also like, you know, if your analysis is not historically sound and you just kind of have these broad left ideas, like Occupy is a great example.
Yeah,
the 99% versus the 1%.
Yeah. And, like, the inequality is bad, which, like, it for sure is.
Right.
And, like, people are tired and alienated, which they for sure are.
But that's it. Like, that's your only analysis, and you don't have, like, a historical basis, a historical materialist perspective as the basis for your political praxis. You just have those ideas. It's super easy to make the jump from the 99% versus the 1% and just to say, oh, well, the 1% is Jewish people.
Right,
right.
You know, the 1% is these other, you know, these other people
right.
that are controlling everything. Like that, if you don't have the
right.
materialist analysis that led you up to a class struggle perspective,
right.
then that jump is super easy to make.
Right, and yeah, and it definitely happened in some cases. It's really unfortunate. It's a shame, you know. But like I said, they're a sinister bunch, the far right, and. That is one thing they get really good at is figuring out which populist language they can use and co-opting it very early on, you know? And I think sometimes they do so quite sincerely. I think it's the blind leading the blind. And these people have these just broad enough ideas of like, fuck the elites, whatever. But, you know, maybe they just have that horse blinder for capitalism or whatever. And they're able to replicate that very quickly in some cases. It's very scary, you know?
Well, and like going back to the idea that fascism requires mass politics, right? They have to be fundamentally against the current status quo, right? The upheaval of class society is an integral part of the fascist movement.
Right.
And therefore, they will try to enter into budding revolutionary movements and try to swing them into a counter-revolutionary or a fascist direction. You know, they will try to siphon energy off. They will try to recruit from those circles because people, it's easy to get downtrodden and disaffected as a leftist.
Like, oh, yeah.
really? It's easy to fall into despair, you know?
I hadn't noticed.
And if somebody's just like, well, you know what, at least those fascist guys over there, at least they're beating the shit out of people. I want to beat the shit out of somebody.
Yeah, I'm mad, dog.
I'm mad, dog. Exactly. Like,
I'm Mad Dog 2020. Hell yeah, let's do it, bro.
All these Marxist-Leninists ever do is have meetings. Like,
yeah, no, I get it. And they do. And that's, believe me, they're just because, you know, there may have been some criticism of what you'd call like ultra-left or whatever. There are plenty of criticisms to go around of the Marxist-Leninist organizations in this country.
Oh, yeah.
And the Maoist organizations in this country that seem to do nothing but yell at each other. And yeah, we're pretty much going to shit on all of them because that's fine.
Yeah.
Because I have a microphone, motherfucker, and you don't.
Well, I think that like what's interesting about like the Maoist or the Marxist-Leninist parties is that they are not able to have that militant edge that the anarchists have, because the only reason the anarchists are able to get away with their militancy is because they are decentralized and they work in small groups that are more difficult for the feds to track. Versus a Marxist-Leninist vanguard party, once a large organization like that has leaders and a party structure and everything. everything. Once they start talking about violent revolution, that's when the FBI comes in and fucking assassinates their top 10 people or throws their leaders in jail or does, you know.
What? Like, when did that ever happen to the Black Panther Party?
They know that the U.S. government is not fucking around, and so they kind of, it dulls their militancy.
Yeah.
And it makes people enter very hopeful, and then like when they don't have that militant edge, then people feel like, well, all we're kind of doing is just talking about revolution.
Would you say that that makes a pitch for smaller, more decentralized organizations in this day and age then?
I mean, I definitely think that, like, reading up on, like, Che and Mao and the, like, guerrilla warfare and the, like, protracted people's war is kind of, like, the way that those tactics can be applied today, I would say, is a better shot at operating in the current theater than a Marxist-Leninist vanguard party. I think that you're going to look... I think that eventually there does need to be a more cohesive left-wing party to kind of centralize and plan the economy out, but we're not to that stage yet.
No.
I think that we're currently at the stage of a disorganized insurrection that is going to need to build those small insurrectionary groups that can then later be coalesced under a banner once the class conflict gets more acute.
Ah.
You know, it's kind of where I think.
Yeah.
I think that both tactics have their time and place, but I think that we might be putting, like, putting the cart before the horse a little bit to say, like, oh, we need to build a giant revolutionary
vanguard party.
I'm like, no, we need, you know, that's not how asymmetrical warfare works. If you have an organization that's too big and too public and too well organized, the U.S. government's just going to fucking kill your top 20 people.
Right.
Because that's what they do.
Yeah, why wouldn't they?
You know?
And they get away with it.
Versus if you are more decentralized, then it's a lot harder for them to use those kind of decapitation tactics.
Right. That would actually be a good thing to talk about in the next episode, too. The number of activists and Black Lives Matter groups that have conveniently died.
Oh, dude, did you see the leader of the Breonna Taylor protest was killed in a carjacking with no suspects?
Yeah, that frequently happens.
Yeah.
There never is. Nobody's ever, like, several Ferguson people got killed, and I don't know if anybody was ever brought to justice on any of that.
No. Well, and they weren't just killed. They were all found killed in the same way.
Yeah.
Like, five or six of them were found, they were shot, and then they were dumped into the back of a car, which was then lit on fire.
Yeah.
Like, five or six of them died that way. And the cops just kind of went, no suspects. What are y'all going to do about it?
That is a good question. What are we going to do about it?
Right.
This looks like a job for Scoob and the gang. And then just like an unmarked black van rolls up and beats the shit out of Fred.
Fred's white.
Yeah.
He doesn't. And, they're like, and clean cut.
They're like, we're going to go try to catch Ghost again.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. No, they beat the shit out of. They'd find a. An eighth of an ounce of pot on Shaggy and just beat the shit out of him
And shoot Scooby.
Yeah. Oh, 100%.
Scooby was a threat to them.
100%.
Great big Great Dane like that.
Yeah.
Dead.
Disgusting. All right. What's the next point?
The next point is nationalism is itself considered the core motivating vision of fascism. Yet, it is only actually a subset of the larger identitarian trend. Tribalism, of which nationalism is only one type, is the key component of this assertion of essential identity. Nationalism is a version of this that will always be tied to the nation-state, and therefore tribalism placed in a modern context necessitates itself through nationalism, but this is not universal. The modern fascist movement redefines itself consistently in praxis, and reimagining that tribalism means that how they divide up the tribe and the social authorities that reinforce the boundaries of that tribe can change. And I think that an excellent example of this is the fact that the Proud Boys allow certain ethnic minorities into their ranks.
Oh, yeah.
And they practice tokenism really, really well.
Yeah.
And they're able to kind of say, well,
we're Western chauvinists, baby.
Yeah, we're Western chauvinists. We're not racists, right? We're Western chauvinists.
Right.
And as long as you're a Western chauvinist, then we don't care about the color of your skin.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's the funny thing, too, because I believe there are extra rules for, like, Black Proud Boys and Mexican Proud Boys that are like, you have to acknowledge that white people aren't the problem.
Yeah.
Which, like, very,
Yeah.
You know, I think that those rules are only put in, like, whatever contract or whatever for, like, those Proud Boys. It's really fucked up. Mm-hmm. Like, Yeah, no, I was about to say, the other thing that I think a lot about is like how, kind of how we define whiteness in this country is changing and in flux really for probably the most intense way because of like kind of the way the Hispanic population is incorporating. Kind of the same way we saw with like Italians and Irish people and other things like, you know, 75, 80, 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. Those lines are changing and they are going to be able to scoop up some people that you wouldn't think they would be able to scoop up using their nationalist rhetoric, using the right populist rhetoric. And you're right. Those goalposts always seem to move, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's a good way to explain why the fascist movement in the United States behind Trump is so, it's so baffling to people, right? Like, well, how can all these women be voting for him? He obviously, clearly despises women.
Yeah.
Like, how do all these, you know...
Yeah, he's a rape monster, to be clear.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And so it's like the idea of the nation state and the nation as opposed to the ethnic people is kind of an interesting twist to fascism in the American context, right? Because in Italy, it was, you know, Italy for Italians.
Right.
And in Germany, it was the Aryan race, you know, right, versus like the mythologized Aryan race. Versus in the United States, you know, there are Aryan groups that kind of follow like that old ethnic like line.
Right.
But that's not the majority of them. The majority of them are like you said, Western chauvinists, or it's more about like American culture, like who's a quote unquote real American. And being a real American is defined by what your values are. Right.
Right.
And if your values are
reactionary enough,
like if your values are that, oh, if you were born here, then you're an American. But if you were born here and you don't like it and you don't leave, then you're not an American. And if you weren't born here, then you're the enemy. Like, and right, it doesn't directly revolve around a specific mythologized race. It's now surrounding a mythologized nationality, which is an interesting distinction.
Yeah. And I think that we're, I don't know, like, how does that compare to, like, is the fascism that's popping up in Europe still very ethnic?
Right.
By comparison? Like, mm-hmm. Even the modern fascism? Yeah, right? Like, in Poland and in Hungary and in places like that. What are the implications of that going forward? I think that, honestly, the thing that makes that the most scary to me is that it can be a much more amorphous blob that can kind of mold into whatever it needs to be at any given time.
Yeah.
In a way that more strict ethnic lines couldn't be, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. It allows for that kind of politics to take on the character of a populace like the United States that has like 400 million people and so many different groups.
Right.
It's just a much larger theater of operation than historical like Weimar Germany or Italy in the 20s would have been.
Right. And it makes it much harder to figure out who would be more sympathetic to left-wing alternatives and not, you know?
Yeah.
It's certainly, you know, those...
But it's tribalism,
right?
At the end of the day, it's fascism is the in-group deserves this land. We deserve these resources by our birthright.
Right.
And everybody else that we don't consider to be part of our tribe needs to either leave or we're going to make you leave.
Exactly.
That, like, if you boil it all the way down, it's tribalism and essentialized identity.
Right.
You know?
But it's just weird that it's now coming up, you know, as it always does with capitalism and crisis, in a place that is, like, so ethnically diverse. Mm-hmm. In a place that is so politically diverse. In a place that, like, we've talked about a million times, is just, like, 50 weird little countries that all operate in kind of a clusterfuck situation, you know?
Yeah.
It's you're right. It turns the whole thing into the fucking blob. And it's like, what, how do you fight the blob, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at like the far right memes about how that we need to just like cut California, Washington, and Oregon out of the United States. Right.
Yeah.
And make the real Americans like, and we're just going to cut out like these portions with the coastal elites.
Right.
Like, you know, even people who are Americans and who were born here can be pushed outside of the tribe, yeah. You know.
Oh, absolutely. And many of them will be. I mean, a lot of it is especially when the tribe is built along ideological lines more so than anything else, which is, I mean, the tribe always had to be built on ideological lines to some extent, but you always had something else you could couple it with. And now it seems like there's still always going to be elements of that. I mean, obviously, like, kind of the far right in this country is still predominantly white, predominantly male, whatever. But, like, yeah, the fact that, like, you can... that there's a buy-in for other people that is so vague and just purely ideological is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. That kind of moves into number 10 pretty well.
Sweet.
Number 10 says, ethnic nationalism is a foundational principle of fascism today, a type of racial tribalism which is not relegated only to white nationalism or to the civic nationalism of Western nations. This draws on an ethno-pluralist ethic of nationalism for all peoples, which attempts to ally with nationalist components of third world national liberation movements, minority nationalist movements, and those resisting Western imperialist powers. When racial nationalism is used as a component solution to confronting oppressive powers, it makes itself the potential ally of a fascist logic that sees the answer to capitalism and imperialism in authoritarian forms of identitarianism.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, like, kind of how the third way here, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and third positionism is a couple points down. But yeah, it is kind of leading into that, right?
Right.
Like, the fascists put themselves up as being... anti-globalization, and the mythic past that they are trying to harken back to is one where every different ethnic group all lived in isolation from each other and had clear boundaries, right? That's the fundamental myth, is that once upon a time, all the ethnic groups lived separately. There was no intermixing.
Right.
And
which is absurd, because that was never, ever the thing.
Never the case. But
yeah, never once the case in humanity. Yeah.
Yeah. But by putting themselves forward as being anti-globalization in that sense and trying to say, well, we don't want to exterminate these other races. We just want to have this land for our race, and we want that race to have that land over there.
Right. The land that we've already pillaged and conquered and stripped and,
yeah,
you know,
strip mined and, yeah, yeah, and polluted and dropped nuclear bombs on.
Right. And you know, certainly our CEOs and their massive influence aren't going to leave those continents, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's always the thing that was always been so funny to me, is like these people who fight for ethno states, and the Richard Spencer types, and the, you know, Africa for Africans and Asia for, it's like, okay, well, is Nestle going to leave Africa then? Your white American company, you know what I mean?
Well, like, what they say is like, yes. And they put themselves forward in that sense as being anti-capitalist.
Right.
You know, oh, well, yeah, obviously they'll agree with you. Like, oh, yeah, obviously we should be restricting trade. We should have tariffs. We should have, you know, not our corporations should be national, not transnational. And like, and that would be a better economy, because then we'd all be able to trade and there right. wouldn't be these monopolies.
Right.
We
wouldn't just be trading one exploiter for another or anything like that. Or those companies wouldn't just find backdoor ways into those, you know, through mm-hmm. the corrupt companies that, you know, didn't that pop up because there's no infrastructure in a lot of those parts of the world to, like, especially economic infrastructure to, like, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like the same thing that always happens, right? It's like you work so they strip mine these places, they destroy these places, and then they leave them with, like, nothing to. So it's like at the end of the day, it's like, if I don't even know what I'm trying to say here. You know what I'm trying? Do you see what I'm trying to say? We would make sure that they're set up so they would still be codependent on us in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, it's not that this can actually happen.
Yeah, it could never realistically actually happen.
But
also,
this is the language and the mythology that they use to get through the door, right? And that's and that fundamental aspect of their politics is that separatism, that national, that, like, isolationism and separatism,
right?
You know, it makes it easy for them to appear to have a coherent logic.
Right.
And that is what is so dangerous about that. Right. And I think that if you talk about, like, ethno-pluralist ideas like that, it speaks to a lot of people who grew up in segregated America in particular, and who remember when there were only white people in the neighborhood. And they remember that because it was concurrently a time of economic boom as being a better time.
Right.
And so that fascist logic is really insidious in the United States in particular, because we have that context of segregation and the fact that a lot of our cities are still segregated.
Right.
You know, and they this say... one. Well, look, you know, wouldn't it be better if we just let the black people have this area over here and we just have this area over here? And the implicit message in that is that their outcomes wouldn't be as good as our outcomes because we are racially superior, right?
Right.
And that's like, but they don't say that out loud. They just say, well, let them do what they're going to do over there and let us do what we're going to do over here. We see what happens there already, you know? And it divorces it from that larger socioeconomic context, and it puts it in the context of that myth of ethnopluralism.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fucked.
It is. It sure is.
And that leads to number 11, which is that fascism's focus on immigration, founded on the desire for monoracial countries, draws on anxieties that are often tied to left organizing. The offshoring of jobs due to neoliberal globalization, isolationist rhetoric in the anti-war movement, labor institutions' fears of immigrant workers driving down wages, environmental fears associated with population growth, the scapegoating of Islamic immigrants for supposedly repudiating liberal norms, and the smug liberal secularism of the U.S. coasts are all well mobilized by fascist movements attempting to use liberal modes of thought for their own anti-immigrant populism.
Again, they're taking our good points and they're throwing their special little twist on them,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, yeah, obviously moving all your jobs to another country and destroying manufacturing is not good, but it's not the fault of the people in that country that happened. It's the fault of our government and their government deciding that exploiting everybody in this way was a good thing, and you know, our businesses. And they, but again, they're able to just work in, it seems like, that implicit, like, look at these damn filthy non-white people that took your jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, like, especially talking about the scapegoating of Islamic immigrants for repudiating liberal norms, you see that a lot in America in particular. Like, talking about how, oh, well, you know, Islamic countries are oppressive to women, you know.
Right.
They don't have civil rights because they're backward and because they're, you know, they talk about how, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that Islamic countries are like 600 years behind Christian countries because, you know, Islam was founded like 600 years after Christianity was
Jesus.
You know, something like that, where they talk about how the Islamists are, you know, backward or they're not enlightened, right?
Right.
And I think that what that does is it takes that entire region of the world out of context of what happened to it at the beginning of the 20th century, right? The fall of the Ottoman Empire was absolutely disastrous for that region. What happened when the Ottoman Empire was carved up by the Western nations and all the neo-colonial tactics that they used to maintain control of those territories for their economic purposes,
right,
while totally ignoring the cultural, the language, the ethnic, the religious barriers that existed in those places, and just watching the powder keg that
just explode. Just explode.
Because the Ottomans had been doing a really good job for a really long time of making peace between all of these different ethnic groups that were under their jurisdiction, right? There was not a lot of ethnic strife because the Ottomans were the ones who were kind of keeping, you know, the order, right?
Right.
And it was obviously tenuous, and the Ottoman government was guilty of genocide against the Armenians, not,
yeah,
you know...
Yeah, not for nothing. Not, I mean, they
not
certain,
for nothing.
Yeah, like, they certainly...
Not glorifying them at all.
Yeah, they certainly were authoritarian, brutal... And that certainly is one way to keep the peace.
Yeah, but what was happening in the Ottoman Empire was that they were trying to hold on to the feudal relations of power upon which they had been built, because the Ottoman Empire was a feudal institution.
Right.
And capitalism had been creeping in, but there were a lot of direct laws that the Ottomans had against sort of foundational capitalist concepts, right? And capitalism wasn't able to, like, fully take off in the Islamic world.
Right.
And it was top down, right? It was literally explicitly not allowed to happen.
Right.
Until the Ottoman Empire collapsed at the end of World War I, and the United States and the imperialists from the West came in and said, ooh, goody, look at all these fresh feudal markets that we can exploit these laborers for nothing. Right. Look at all this oil that we can get for nothing, you know? And so what the Slavoj Žižek in his book on violence says that, and I use this line a lot, that in the West, in Europe, we had time to adjust to capitalism. And instead of breaking our social institutions, they bent.
Yeah.
And they slowly changed over time. Versus the Islamic world was hit by the shattering impact of industrial capitalism.
Yeah, post-World War One. So was the entire Eastern Bloc after 1917.
Same thing happened there, right, yeah. And so, but
yeah, when you're trying to build your entire infrastructure for capitalism in a few decades instead of a few centuries, ugly shit happens, absolutely.
And so looking at the fact that people in those regions faced with that economic reality have clung so tightly to their religion, have clung so tightly to their ethnicity as their source of their pride, mm-hmm. and their, you know, as the sort, and it seems backwards to us, right? Because we come from America where it's like, oh, well, multiculturalism is the name of the game, right? We have to have that multicultural value set, and it's backward and wrong to have, you know, these people who want to have, you know, ethno-national liberation movements in these parts of the world, right?
Right.
And the equating of white ethno-nationalism and Islamic ethno-nationalism, simply because they both are repudiating those liberal norms, right?
Right.
It draws a false equivalence.
Well, I mean, that's literally exactly what liberals do when they try to compare the far right and the far left, right? Mm-hmm. If you are repudiating the liberal status quo in any way, it doesn't matter what your material basis for it is or what your actual praxis is or what you actually want to see happen. They are cut from the same cloth,
mm-hmm.
period. And people do the same thing. The idea that, you know, nationalist movements in, not certainly not maybe ethno ones, but nationalist movements that happen in countries where they're fighting, you know, against colonial oppressors versus nationalism in a place where you're trying to be the colonial oppressor still is very, it's a different mix for sure.
Yeah. Well, I remember, like, there was a quote from a member of the YPG, the Kurdish forces in Syria, talking about the importance of nationalism to the Kurds.
Right.
As a people who live in diaspora, the importance of nationalism to their liberation struggle against Turkey and against the Assad government,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's something that we tend to just shoot down, right? Like, oh, well, nationalism is obviously bad. Like, it's an anti-left idea. And it's not that cut and dry.
It would be really nice if it was, but it's not in many cases. And it's not going to be, and those liberation forces still need to fight and still need to have some kind of an ideological center to be around.
And I think that it's really important that we always call out, like, the scapegoating of particularly Islamic people.
Yeah.
Particularly that, because I hear a lot of that on the left in this country talking about how those people in those other countries are not our comrades, or they're, you know, they aren't coming at it from the right place, you know, like they're oppressive, they don't follow liberationary norms, and it's like, it just totally ignores the history of what happened in that region over the past 100 years.
Right.
You know?
And it's not like we don't have, you know, millions of people from that part of the world living in this country, not murdering women.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like they're people that live under their government that does horror. That would be like you going to Saudi Arabia and then being like, what, you don't beat up Mexican children every day? Like,
yeah.
You know, yeah, of course you fucking don't. Like, you know, there are much more large and nefarious things at play than you and your individual situation. All right. I think we're at about, we're at almost an hour. Yep. I think we're...
And, like, the next couple of points are talking about kind of the same thing that we've been talking about here, like third positionism and, yeah.
Hell yeah. Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave it while we go scramble and try to figure out what we're doing for our next episode here.
We already ate all the pumpkin pie.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was delicious. And that's what's important. Who made that? Your grandma?
No, I get it from Frisch's, baby.
Oh, you got
number
it
from one. Dude, my mom, Frisch's pumpkin pie is so good. My mom literally turned to me when we were eating it yesterday, and she was like, why would you make it at this point? It's Frisch's is so good with their pumpkin pie.
It is. All their pie is so good. Delicious. Number one pie-related podcast.
This is the number one Frisch's podcast in southeastern Ohio.
Woo! Woo! Well, with that, Jack, thanks for walking us through that conversation again. It was definitely, it took a lot of the stuff you kind of foundationally laid last time and gave us kind of a really nice cultural perspective and kind of made us realize, like, ooh, this is a very unique flavor of fascism we're dealing with in this country. So do you have any closing thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think that, like, what you just said there, it's a very interesting flavor of fascism in the United States. And I think that it's very easy for us in the United States to say that we don't have fascist politics here, you know, or that that calling somebody a fascist is just something that the left wing does to kind of say, oh, well, I don't agree with you, so you're a fascist, right?
Right.
Oh, I don't like your ideas, so you're a fascist. Oh, the left wing are the real fascists because they want to be the thought police and they want to make it so that you can't think these different things.
Right.
And, you know, you hear a lot of that stuff coming out of the American right wing,
sure.
Especially, you know, oh, well, you know, fascism isn't real. And it's like, well, you know, those people have a very basic, like, grade school understanding of what fascism is, right?
Right.
And they think that the only way to have, by design, yeah, the only way to have fascist politics is to have people marching with swastika flags down the street and killing people. And it's like, that's one way that fascism iterated itself in a particular national context. And in fact, the people who kind of LARP the old Nazi uniforms and the swastikas and things like that, yeah, they are such a small part of a much larger fascist movement in the United States. A fascist movement that has members in the government, the police, the military, you know, the civilian militias, local and state governments. The FBI put out their, you know, their counterterrorism report and talked about the danger of white nationalists and fascist terrorism in the United States, right?
Mm.
And one of the big things that it talked about in that report was the way that white nationalists in the United States have this propensity for violence that doesn't fit within a particular political program. Like, their ideas seem so far off base when they actually do these terrorist attacks. Like, oh, I'm going to start a race war.
Right.
You know, or I'm going to I'm going to make it so that the United States government is going to crack down on all the black people by blowing up this car, this building. You know, I'm going to carry out this mass shooting to show everybody, like, and the bringing of those weird politics directly into the public space in that very violent and insurgent form.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the threat of white nationalist violence and fascist violence in the United States so poignant. And,
right,
and going forward, I think that it's just going to get more intense, because as the economic contradictions that underlie those that fascist violence get more and more acute, you're going to continue to see people get drawn into that. And it's really important that we start pointing out to people, you know, that's a bad idea. Like, that is an idea that leads to this fascist point, or that feeds into this fascist machine.
Sure.
Because I hear a lot of people say a lot of things in common casual discourse in the United States that in my mind I'm thinking, like, ooh, that is really, really, you know, that potentially lays the groundwork for them to support the kind of atrocities that we have already seen and are going to continue to see.
Sure. Well, I think that about does it for this week. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. And on our honor, we will do our best. Smash capitalism! Bye-bye.